Well, if this is all getting cut anyways, there's a past version of Andrew who would have been like, "Don't you dare."
Hello and welcome to A Century in Cinema. My name is Arthur. I'm a filmmaker here in Utah and also a new cat dad. New cat dad. She's tearing up everything.
And my name is Andrew. I'm a professional film historian. And Arthur, I don't care about your cat. We can get through this together, okay? I'm coming back to my hometown. We always found each other. Your mom knows that. We always found each other.
I only invited you on this podcast because my cat wanted you right? to be on this podcast.
Exactly, yeah. You're lying. And then the cat just goes,
she felt bad for you. This is a podcast where we watch and discuss a classic film that I have not seen.
But I most likely have.
From every year. This week, we're in 2011. We're watching Young Adult, directed by Jason Reitman, written by Diablo Cody, and starring Charlize Theron. For any new listeners, you can find where our movies are streaming or available to rent online down in the link in our show notes. I streamed this one on the fledgling streaming service, a little something called HBO Max.
I did the same, although I have to say I'm probably gonna buy this.
Well, we're not into general thoughts and opinions quite yet, Andrew.
I know,
but
I just wanted to give that heads up. People need to know what they're getting into.
Before we get into our film of the week, we're going to give our listeners a little bit of context for the year 2011. A lot is going on in 2011 in the world. Japan is hit by a massive tsunami and earthquake that causes a nuclear disaster at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. You, of course, remember this.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
You, of course, remember the Arab Spring when protests in the Middle East sweep from country to country very, very quickly, likely due to the rise of social media. And we are definitely still feeling the effects of that today. Some countries like Tunisia, they have like a relatively okay revolution transition sort of thing. Other countries like Syria descend into civil war and kind of collapse. It's not good. Definitely a lot to talk about there. But we're going to go over to Pakistan, where Osama bin Laden is killed by U.S. forces.
I was at the University of Montevallo, and opinions were very split, but there was no denying that the people who were very celebratory in a macabre fashion, I would describe, were very vocal, and I don't know. That was a weird night.
Certainly was. Also kind of infamous because it was the first time that a major news story like this broke on Twitter before any of the major news outlets knew what was going on.
I think I remember that too.
Yeah, so social media is becoming a big part of the world. And of course, we want to mention the protests in the United States, the Occupy Wall Street movement later on in the year, which I remember being very into. This was my first year in college, and I was definitely looking forward to all sorts of new ideas, and I was into politics. So yeah, the Occupy Wall Street movement kind of hit me at the right time.
The one thing I remember is when the Dark Knight Rises trailer dropped, I was like, oh, Anne Hathaway saying the 99%. Yeah, I mean, this was all over the news and everything. I mean, this is still a conversation topic today. The buzzwords from it, at least, are still very much in local colloquialisms as of 2022.
The 99% versus the 1%.
Right.
Yes. Let's look at what's at the top of the box office. No big surprises here. It is sequels and franchises galore. Number one, worldwide box office with $1.3 billion, Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows Part 2. Number two, Transformers Dark of the Moon. What is that doing up there? And number three, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. This is the fourth one?
Fourth.
Fifth one? Okay.
Fourth. That's the fourth one.
Okay. And then number four, Twilight, Breaking Dawn Part 1.
It's funny you mentioned the sequels. Did you know that according to the Guinness Book of World Records, this is the most sequels released in a calendar year?
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, 27 sequels released in a calendar year. The previous record was 24 sequels in 2003. Did you have any emotional attachment to Deathly Hallows Part 2? Do you have memories of seeing that?
Oh, absolutely. I didn't go to many midnight premieres in the day, but I definitely went to the midnight premiere of that in a packed theater with a ton of friends. It was a grand old time. I don't remember like crying in the theater, but yeah, I was emotional watching it for sure.
So I do. I
You were.
This is a very embarrassing story that I am so willing to share on this podcast. At the end of Deathly Hallows Part 2, when they played the music that plays at the end of Sorcerer's Stone when he puts his kids on the train, I just literally couldn't stop crying. I was like so, I don't know, I just felt like this huge release of so many things in my life. I don't know, I just started crying and crying and crying. Next thing I knew, my friend Jessica was like tugging on my arm and she was walking me out, and I still like couldn't even like see or perceive things. And I was like fully hyperventilating from crying so hard. I was sat down outside of the theater, you know, wiped away my eyes and was like looking up like, oh my God, like still crying and still sort of heaving. And the theater manager was in front of me and he said, are you okay?
And what did you say?
I don't remember. I literally, that's where the memory stops. I'm like, I have no idea. I'm sure I said something like, yeah, I'm fine.
We were Harry Potter fans. We are still Harry Potter fans, I assume, a little bit, kind of. Recent events, yeah, I don't know. So yeah, I understand that feeling of release and that feeling of closure, things coming to a real end. This did feel like a real culmination of that part of our lives. And I mean, I graduated from high school in 2011. This felt like the end of something for me, for sure.
Industrial Light and Magic, who I think the last time they were mentioned was when I mentioned they had invented the mocap technology for Pirates of the Caribbean Dead Man's Chest, released their first animated film this year, which was Rango. And I still think visually you can tell this is made by a bunch of professionals who are good at their jobs. This was the year that film studios first started turning their eye a little bit towards streaming. DirecTV had a deal with four major studios, Sony, Fox, Universal, and Warner Brothers, and their films would be available on DirecTV's pay-per-view program 2 months after their theatrical release, before they were released on home video. And there was a big hoorah around this at the time. People were really upset saying, this is the end of the movie theater.
Oh, it's a slow end of the movie theater.
Yes.
But yes, streaming is a big deal this year, isn't it? I remember watching, man, a ton of TV shows through streaming. Binging becomes a real thing around this time.
This is also the year when Netflix doubles the price of their subscription if you wanted to keep the DVD rental service.
And a lot of people said, no, thank you.
Yep. People chose the streaming. Oh, I do distinctly remember Cars 2 coming out, and it's the lowest grossing Pixar film at this point. They've had lower grossing since, obviously, especially with the whole Disney Plus fiasco recently. But I remember Cars 2, even more so than its predecessor, was the first, like, dent in the Pixar armor that was fully visible to everyone. I do have some recommendations from 2011.
Obscure recommendations. I saw a lot of films this year. Let's see if I saw any of these obscure ones.
Ooh. So, first up, I want to bring Todd Haynes' HBO miniseries Mildred Pierce, starring Kate Winslet and Evan Rachel Wood. The melodrama adaptation starring Joan Crawford was very famous in its own right, but also sort of infamous for anyone who'd read the book, because when you watch that movie for the first 20 minutes, you wonder if they have just made up their entire own plot and put in character names, because it has nothing to do with the book at all. And then when it does the flashbacks, it shows that it is the same plot, it just has a completely different ending. Todd Haynes presented the book as is with this beautiful miniseries. It is so gorgeously shot. I think there is room for both to exist. I think he has a lot of respect for the film as well as the book, and it shines through in this adaptation. Next up is Wim Wenders, or I guess it's Wim Wenders. I say Wim Wenders sometimes. Wim Wenders' Pina 3D. Did you see this?
Nope, didn't see this one.
This is the film of choreography by Pina Bausch, a very famous contemporary choreographer. these dances take place sometimes on stage, sometimes in real locations such as subway trains and in parks. The dances are so cool. They are always very conceptual. But the 3D was amazing. So the way the 3D worked, it was like the apron of the stage was what was sort of coming out at you. So when you were sitting in a movie theater, it actually looked like you were sitting in a real live theater with a stage in front of you and people were performing on it.
Cool. That's cool.
So awesome. And then when it switches into the other more filmic stuff, when it goes outside, it does sort of lose that magic a little bit, but it was still so cool to watch it in 3D. I absolutely loved it. And I still love the film. I've watched it in 2D many times as well. This was one I loved putting on at the Tower back in the day because it's a movie you can walk in and watch 5 minutes of and say, huh. Next up, I'm going to recommend Tom McCarthy's Win-Win, starring Paul Giamatti as a down-and-out middle-aged man who reignites his passion for life by becoming a wrestling coach.
Oh, I haven't seen this one either.
It's a great movie. It's really well-written, really funny. Paul Giamatti, Alex Schaefer, and Amy Ryan are all wonderful in this movie, as is Jeffrey Tambor. And the ending, it just wells up my heart a little bit. I love that movie. Now, I'm definitely going to mention some that I'm pretty sure you've seen. Next up, I'm going to bring up Bernie, directed by Richard Linklater.
There we go. Yeah, I've seen this one. I love it.
Starring Jack Black, Shirley MacLaine, and Matthew McConaughey. This is a wild and wacky movie about this very charismatic man who loves his mother deeply in a small town in Texas. And that's really all you need to know about it. This is, I think, Jack Black's best performance. I do love him a lot as a performer in general. I find him very funny. And this is a serious role, but the character himself is still very eccentric and over the top. And you can imagine that if in real life you were in a small town in Texas and everyone sort of started blending together, someone with Jack Black's personality would stand out a little bit more. And yeah, it's just a very twisted tale, a very dark comedy. You know how much I love me a dark comedy. And I mean, it's tough. My last recommendation, I think, is going to be Lars von Trier's Melancholia.
Yep, there we are.
This is one of my favorite movies. I, to date, think this is the best depiction of depression I've ever seen on film. Portrayed beautifully by Kirsten Dunst and written achingly by Lars von Trier about the impending end of the world brought on by a planet that has been named Melancholia that is inevitably going to crash into Earth, and how Kirsten Dunst's character and her sister handle it in different ways. I love this movie. I don't have much else to say about it. If you haven't seen Melancholia, I highly recommend you seek it out. Even just the opening 10 minutes is some of the most gripping cinema. It's just so, so good. I love it so much.
I generally don't like Lars von Trier's films, but I really like Melancholia.
And of course, Tree of Life comes out this year. There are like big movies that come out this year that are really great that weren't necessarily big, such as Drive, Tree of Life, We Need to Talk About Kevin, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I don't think any of these movies were made with the intention of being huge, well-seen movies. They all have very small budgets and are telling kind of more modest stories. But they hit the zeitgeist, I should say. Oh, but wait. One more.
Okay, one more.
And that's Wes Craven's final film, Scream 4, which I will go on record saying is the best Scream sequel. Have you seen this one? Have you watched these movies?
No. I've seen the first one.
Oh my God. Scream 4 is a sequel that came out years after Scream 3, and its point that it's making, because all the Scream movies make sort of a point, is how ridiculous it is to have all of these movie series have a new movie come out, you know, decades later and stuff, just trying to reignite a franchise while Scream 4 itself is doing that for the Scream franchise. So yeah, those are my recommendations from 2011. If I didn't say your favorite, get over it. A lot of good movies came out this year.
I am not going to get over it. I'm going to recommend The Raid.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, I love this genre of films, the excuse to have one action set piece after another kind of movie. Jackie Chan films like this are great, and I feel like this is a great example of a contemporary continuation of that genre. I don't think I can pronounce the star's name, Iko Uwais. He's from Indonesia, but man, he is brutal. It's just a great action movie. One of the best.
But you know what movie I hate from this year?
What?
The Artist.
I like The Artist, but I understand the hate.
And then it won Best Picture, and I was like, okay, this was like a wonderful year for movies, but whatever. Anyways.
Should we talk about Young Adult, our film for the year?
Yes, we can talk about Young Adult. I have the plot this week. So, Young Adult tells the story of Mavis Gary. She is a 37-year-old young adult writer who has been recently divorced and whose book series has been canceled. Seemingly out of the blue, Mavis receives an invite to her old high school flame, Buddy's, baby naming ceremony. She decides she wants to take Buddy back and returns to her hometown. There she wreaks havoc through her social ineptitude and borderline insane behavior in a dire pitch to get Buddy to leave his wife and kid. She also runs into an old high school acquaintance named Matt, who is the only person who will be upfront with her about how horribly she's handling her life. At the baby naming ceremony, it is revealed that the town is one step ahead of her. It was not Buddy who invited her, but his wife. All of the people who used to know her are genuinely concerned by her decisions and attitude. She dismisses them, runs away, sleeps with Matt, and the next morning talks to Matt's sister. The sister convinces her that nothing is wrong with her, and so Mavis gets in her car and drives away, seemingly having learned nothing. So I first saw this movie when it was in theaters. I saw it by myself opening weekend. That was a pretty classic moment in 2011 in Alabama for me. And I was there and there were maybe three other people in the theater and I was laughing so hard. I was cackling. And eventually the other people in the theater got on board and realized that they weren't going to laugh. It was just going to be a painful, horrible experience. So by the end, everyone was laughing, especially the big breakdown at the baby naming ceremony. And then I watched it again when I moved to Utah a few years later, and James and I were living together for the first time. And I showed it to him saying, this is one of my favorite comedies that's come out in recent memory. And he loved it. And then watched it for a third and fourth time this past week. When the week started, I watched it because I knew I needed to watch it for the podcast, and again invited James over, and we both loved watching it again. And then I just watched it this morning because why not? And I had time.
Why not?
There's something about this movie that speaks to me on a very profound level. I see a lot of myself in this character, not in the way she behaves or the way she treats people, but a lot of stuff in her situation and things that could potentially go through my mind, I see in her, and I see it portrayed in such a horrifying and despicable way that it reminds me, you know what, Andrew, you're doing pretty good. Like, you're doing pretty good. This movie just makes me laugh so hard, and I think it's so beautifully acted and written and directed. I just think everything about this movie really sings for me. And this was sort of a last-minute trade-out for the podcast, but when I saw it and found out Arthur hadn't seen it, I was like, yeah, I want to watch Young Adult again right now anyways, so let's just kill two birds with one stone. And I'm happy we did, but I also am very curious as to how you felt about this movie.
Do you think that I'm not going to like this film?
I never said that. I just said I was curious.
No, I liked this. I don't think I ever laughed. I didn't find it very funny. But we've been through this before, that your humor is a little darker than mine. And I don't know. It was amusing. I liked her as a character quite a lot. I liked following her and she was very interesting. And I felt, you know, pity for her, even as she's doing despicable things. There's definitely a humor to this. But yeah, I was never laugh out loud laughing. And that's fine. That's okay. It is written by Diablo Cody, who's probably best known for writing Juno. And she has maybe a quirky sensibility with her dialogue. At least that's what I always knew her to have. And I would not have guessed that this was written by the same person who wrote Juno. Juno is a very charming little film. This is it a charming little film?
I wouldn't call this charming.
Charming's not the right word.
I think this movie is aggressive.
Right. And then directed by Jason Reitman, who we mentioned in a previous episode because he directed Up in the Air, one of Andrew's recommendations for that year. But again, kind of a charming little film. Yeah, it feels like a departure for both of those creative minds. It feels like they're doing something different and exploring a different kind of character, which is always exciting as an artist. It's fun to do that kind of thing. And I think they do it very well. Again, the character here is despicable, but I was always very fascinated by her. And Charlize Theron does a great job playing her. You mentioned that Tolly was sort of a spiritual sequel to this. Tolly just recently came out.
Yeah, recently. It came out in 2018.
Well, yeah.
But yeah, Tolly is also written by Diablo Cody, directed by Jason Reitman, and stars Charlize Theron, and also is about a woman who is on the brink. But in this case, she is a mother who, I think she has 3 children, and she's just being pushed to the brink by all of the pressure and how much there is to take care of and how little help she feels like she's getting in general. And then a mysterious housekeeper named Tolly just shows up on her door and starts helping her one day.
Huh. Well, I love this creative team. I think they did a great job with young adult, and I would be very excited to watch Tolly next. It feels like double featuring these just makes a lot of sense.
Yes, but I would, if it's funny you say that, because I was talking about this earlier, and if I were to double feature them, it would be Tolly and then young adult.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tolly, she's just a way more sympathetic character in general, and I think it keys you into the dark humor, but you have someone to really root for. In young adult, you don't really get to root for anybody, and I feel like it needs that sort of leeway into it, and then ending it. I don't know. This is. I have so many thoughts about this movie. I just really feel like it's something very special.
Okay, I laughed when she goes into the department store and she's looking for an outfit to really win Buddy back, and she mentions to the salesperson helping her that she's trying to break up the marriage. That was funny. There's yeah. Funny moments in this for sure.
Let's show him what he's been missing. No, he's seen me recently. He knows. I was going to say, my favorite line in this is when she's writing. Throughout the film, she's writing the final book in her young adult book series.
Mm-hmm.
And you see her insanity coming through in the book and how she's writing this character who is clearly a plug for herself. And there's a line that she's writing right before the big climax, and she says, "Sometimes in order to heal, a few people have to get hurt." And that's just hilarious to me. Like, I don't know, just a complete misunderstanding of what healing is supposed to be. It's kind of like a horror movie. It's even framed like a horror movie to a certain extent, you know? This person returns to their town thinking that they are unannounced and aren't expecting any sort of thing, but they have this one goal, and then it turns out the whole town is aware of them and has been scheming behind their back and do the big reveal. Like, that's like a full Rosemary's Baby reveal at the end when they're like, "We're all really concerned about you," and then her parents are at the naming ceremony as well. They just sort of come out from the crowd and they're like, "Honey," like, I don't know. And then, so it's a horror movie from her angle. And then from their angle, you know, it's like this small town, things are peaceful, and suddenly this demonic presence just comes in and starts, you know, tearing things apart. And
it's a slasher film.
Ruining lives. You know, it's really funny to me how, because this was Diablo Cody's, so this was her third feature length script, and the first was, of course, Juno. The second was Jennifer's Body, which is a dark comedy horror film that I also like quite a bit. And I think that there are just little seeds of her having that horror idea in her mind in this movie. Just the way Charlize Theron sort of stalks around and how she attempts to control every situation around her in this ignorant of people's feelings way it's really terrifying to watch. But it's also just so funny. Yeah, I love this movie.
Yeah, everyone at the time seemed to really love this. I remember critics heaping praise on it.
Which is wild to me, because this is not like a typical crowd-pleasing movie in any sense of the word. I don't know, maybe people were just ready to hate somebody in 2011.
Yeah, I sent you this Roger Ebert review, and the title of it is, quote, "A Queen Bitch Gets Her Comeuppance."
Yeah, this is a very nice review. He's he's very funny in this review. I feel like he's taking on the catty nature of the movie to a certain extent, which I enjoy. My favorite little dig is on other critics when he says, when he's talking about how her alcoholism is depicted in the film. And he says there are some critics writing about this film that are slow to recognize alcoholism. And I think that's funny.
That scene where she tells her parents that she thinks she's an alcoholic and they just kind of laugh.
Yes.
What's your takeaway from that?
So I don't think that we really get a chance to fully sympathize with this character. I think the movie is really wanting the audience to work for that, to work for a certain angle to find sympathy. But I think the closest we get is when we realize, oh, her parents are kind of the worst. They don't seem to have much investment in her current life. They aren't very good at communicating. And then they're the only people who she feels she can do this sort of test run of, I'm an alcoholic, in front of. And their reaction is just exactly what she was, you know, dreading. She doesn't get attention for that.
Mm. Yeah, my takeaway was that this is the kind of person who, you know, even if she does reach out for help, her community just isn't really there for her in a meaningful way. That felt like an important moment.
Yes.
I just like this opening quote from the review. They must have closed their eyes and crossed their fingers while they were making this film. Like you said, not a crowd-pleasing sort of character.
I love, my favorite quote from this is talking about the town themselves, the people who live in the town. Back home in Mercury, they think of her as a glamorous success. Of course, they haven't seen her in years. They're about to. yeah, I like how much he talks about Patton Oswalt in this film as well, because I do think Charlize Theron is the home run that's very easy to pay attention to. But, you know, Patton Oswalt is the one. I'm not good with baseball allegories. Why do I do this to myself? I was going to say he's the one that pitches the ball, but doesn't that mean he's on the opposite team? Anyways, he's involved and he also is very, very good.
It was weird reading this review and realizing that Patton Oswalt in 2011 is still kind of a new face in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he's just someone who's been around for as long as I can remember.
Well, and he's been in movies and TV since the late 90s. This wasn't, you know, his first thing, but he was always just sort of bit parts and people in the background.
Yeah, he is great in this. He's really great.
He's at one point, him and Charlize are in a car outside of Buddy's house. He says, oh, yeah, he drives a Jeep Liberty. She says, oh, how ironic, because he has no liberty. And he just is laughing while sipping a beer and says, you are mentally ill. Oh, man, it's so
That's
good.
The kind of thing. That's the kind of thing a delusional writer would make a connection with.
Yes.
Did you not love that she was an author of young adult vampire romance fiction?
Well, they aren't vampire.
I thought it was.
No. That's what he makes the joke about. There. It's just a high school drama. It's just a classic young adult high school drama series.
Oh, okay.
But then when they're at the bar, they do make that little joke. He's like, are they about vampires? And she rolls her eyes and sips her Maker's Mark.
Okay.
And it's even funnier because the woman playing Buddy's wife is Elizabeth Reeser, who plays the mom in Twilight as well. She was in all the Twilight movies. Did you catch that?
No, I didn't.
Wow, you for loving Twilight so much, you're sure forgetting pretty quick over there.
Eh, maybe it's not so great, actually. In this Ebert review, he mentions that she's writing novels about vampires.
Does he really?
Anyways.
Mm-hmm. Oh my god, I'm doing this. Control F. That is hilarious. No, that is not what's happening in this movie. But, like, that's a funny enough joke that I can see how it could be misconstrued. But yeah, no, they make a joke that they're about vampires because Twilight's so huge in young adult fiction right now, and she rolls her eyes at it.
There we go.
He was having to write like 20 reviews a week while dying, you know, like.
He can make a mistake.
I can forgive this. I can absolutely forgive this.
I have no excuse.
Right. I might have even taken that more internally if I hadn't watched this, you know, a bunch over the years.
So this is the second time the director Jason Reitman and Diablo Cody have collaborated together. The first time was on Juno. Do you want to talk a little bit about their relationship?
Yeah, I just think their story is so cool. Jason Reitman had directed Thank You for Smoking, which is a very dark comedy, and had gotten a lot of acclaim for that and wasn't sure what his next project was going to be. Diablo Cody had written the spec script for Juno, and it was being shopped around, and a producer at Fox picked it up, and Reitman read it and really connected with it and wanted to make it. And it was a very collaborative effort from both of them. Reitman was the one who came up with the idea of the whole movie being framed by the different seasons throughout the year, which I think is a very distinctive part of that film. And Diablo Cody really felt like he gave her script the proper treatment, and they became very good friends. And she wrote this script with the intention of him directing it, but it was looking like things were about to fall through. So she was looking for another director. And then the project he was working on at the time, Labor Day, got delayed. It got pushed back. So he pretty much found 2 months of free time and said, no, I do want to be the one who directs Young Adult. This is so good. And they had very little pre-production time and filmed it in 30 days. Like, this was such a quick movie in Hollywood standards.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, this is my favorite of both of their works. I think this is just so great. It does have this weird epic scope mentally. It feels like it's tackling a lot of subjects, and it's tackling them all very maturely, but it is such a small story and told in such a small way. I think there's something really honorable about that.
I think I just read on Wikipedia that Diablo Cody decided to write this script, Young Adult, because she was getting questions on the press circuit for Juno and then Jennifer's Body. Questions like, why are you so obsessed with stories about, you know, adolescence, young people?
Mm-hmm.
And she asked herself the question, am I stunted? Am I refusing to grow up? Like, what am I doing here? And I like that she I like that she confronts that question through a script, through a movie. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about the relatability of this character later, but I found that to be specifically relatable.
Yes, I do think there is a huge bravery in depicting a character like this and saying, it's based off of me.
Yeah, you don't want to say that. I keep coming back to the word despicable. She is a despicable human being.
Yeah, but I love her.
But we love her.
I do love her. She entertains me. She, you know, like, I feel a little bad for her in the end.
No one said she was boring.
No, she absolutely is not. Yeah, Charlize Theron really carries this movie on her shoulders. And I think Reitman and Cody knew that was who it was going to be. I've never read anything about other people being considered or anything like that. To my knowledge, again, they had that month of pre-production and it was like, okay, call Charlize. Hopefully she's available. And she was, which, yeah, is crazy. Patton Oswalt, I think, was the one who had to audition and they loved him. And then he went to a physical therapist to figure out how people move when they have to walk with a crutch.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I just really wanted that to be a secondhand thing so that when I was acting against Charlize Theron, I wouldn't be thinking about that. But he absolutely holds his own against her, which is, you know, not an easy task. I love how Patrick Wilson, who plays Buddy, I love how he's introduced to us with just his hands handling the breast milk, going into the different pouches and sectioning mm-hmm. things out. That's mm-hmm. so good. That's such a great visual cue to the audience that, no, he's not going to be into this. And in general, I think this movie is so interesting in the way it's presented and written, because from her perspective, you really do start to wonder, well, she keeps doing all this crazy stuff. He seems like he has a level head on his shoulders. Why does he keep inviting her out? Why does he keep her around? And you can't help but betray a little bit of the thought, like, is he, what is going on in his head? And then, yeah, the reveal that it was his wife is like, okay, well, that's the only way this was ever going to make sense, I guess, was that it was somebody else.
Okay, so you have here in our notes that this film subverts the classic sort of character study that you see in films.
Well,
what do you mean by that?
I probably am bad at words. I don't even know if it's a subversion. Oh. It does do the classic character study of here is a person in this moment. And it's not about them changing. It's not about them evolving necessarily. Sometimes it is, but most of the time it isn't. For instance, I would say probably the two most famous character studies I can think of are Taxi Driver and A Clockwork Orange.
Okay.
I don't know if you would agree with that or not.
I think they're great examples. Absolutely.
And I think that with both of those films, you know, we're seeing this person who has so much stuff wrong with their life and make all these decisions that we can't really agree with. But at the end of the day, we do sort of feel a need to root for them. Well, I guess in both of those cases, it's because society at large is so much worse than either of those people actually are.
Society, yeah.
And in this film, society as it's presented through this gaze seems to be almost a victim to her. But the main thing is that it's a woman. Like, you never get to see movies where it's the woman who is the horrible person and doesn't change and you still somehow root for her. You know, that is a very rare thing to see in movies, to the point that right now I can't come up with any examples. I would love some. If you have some, I would love them, but I just have not seen them myself.
No. Usually, and this is a stereotype, but when it comes to these character study films that you're describing, I especially gravitate towards something like Taxi Driver, you know. The woman in that film is like the beating heart. They are the person who represents like the ideal, this person in society who maybe can redeem the man. Well, that's not true. Women can also be horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the stereotype.
Yeah, that's what makes this movie truly feminist. I'm not even really joking. It just is funny to say it like that. I've just never seen a movie quite like this. And this revisit in 2022 really cemented it. Like, I haven't seen anything like this before or since. Like, this didn't even spark anything, really. So maybe not a subversion as much as just, you know, a gender swap. But it's a gender swap that I don't see performed very often in film.
That makes sense. It is interesting, though, that you say that you don't see films like this. Because as I was watching it, I felt like this was very familiar to me. Now, maybe it's because we've been watching some films that are a little bit more out there, a little bit more novel compared to what I'm used to. But this feels like the kind of film that I would go to see at Sundance. And the structure of it just felt very familiar to me. The characters and, you know, again, not changing by the end. I feel like this is pretty normal in Sundance films or these smaller independent films that are character studies. I don't know. There was something very familiar about it. And I don't mean that as a criticism or anything like that. It's just last week we watched Certified Copy. So this felt like more of a normal film compared to some of the other things that we've watched.
Yeah.
But I do not mean that as a criticism. Because very rarely do those films discuss mental illness in any sort of meaningful way.
Yes. Oh, look at you. It's slick with the transition.
And I do think this film handles mental illness in a meaningful way.
I am so blown away by the conversation around mental illness in this movie. 2011 feels closer than it was. But I mean, even thinking within this movie, you know, she has all the newest tech and everything, but her phone still can't get onto the internet. You know what I mean? Like, that was 2011 was a very different time. And the conversations around mental illness have really grown exponentially over, I would say, the last 4 and 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie, it feels like it came out last year as far as the way it's talking about mental illness and it's so open about it.
I would agree.
It feels very ahead of its time with where that conversation was headed. One of my favorite parts of this movie, she's speaking with Buddy's wife and she sees a little chart of the different emotions. And she says, why do you have a chart for emotions? And the wife says, oh, this is for, you know, the special needs kids that I teach who struggle to reach these emotions, you know, so I'm showing them what it's like to be happy, anxious, sad. And Charlize Theron just says, what about neutral? What about when you're not feeling anything? And she just takes, the wife takes a little beat and is like, well, that's what they're feeling most of the time, so we don't really need to train that. And you have this small little reaction shot from Charlize Theron, and you realize, oh, like, that was her. But because she was popular and was pretty and was able to, you know, win prom queen and all of these things, no one ever saw her as somebody who had, you know, emotional special needs in any sort of way.
Hmm.
And I find that so interesting.
I didn't make that connection when I was watching the film. I like that, though.
Yeah, there's a lot of little moments like that where she is sort of confronted with her own behavior and she has to brush it off. Another really great moment is she's at a bar with Buddy and she says, I saw you got a Kentucky hut. And he's like, what's a Kentucky hut? She said, you know, the Kentucky Fried Chicken, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut thing. He's like, oh, that's so clever. You sound like one of those crazy characters from your book. And when he says crazy, it cuts to her and she just like does this little squint and then like goes back into her smile. And again, she's like, the characters in my books aren't crazy. And then as you're hearing her write the book, you're like, no, your characters are pretty crazy. Like, following the plot line of the book she's writing is a really fun way to watch this movie as well. The girl who is so excited that the yearbook is going to be centered around her instead of the child who died.
I gotta watch this again.
Yeah, it gets better every time you watch it. But yeah, like and it's, you know, it's very obviously a parallel to her. There are just these, there are so many layers in this script. It's so genius. She gets really, when they see her cousin, her and Matt are at a bar, and her cousin, who's in a wheelchair, wheels up. And Matt doesn't like him because Matt, who, as we mentioned earlier, has been crippled by this horrible hate crime, he was very depressed about everything that happened. While her cousin is this really optimistic, joyful guy, and he rolls up in a wheelchair and he's like, oh, wow, here comes the happiest cripple in town. And he's so pissed about it. And then she says, yeah, he had no consideration for me at all. He got in that car wreck the weekend of my sweet 16. But they laugh over that and they both have this realization that they are kind of both people who have been stinted in their growth emotionally out of high school. They are both stuck there for different reasons. Anyways, so she makes the comment about someone ruining her sweet 16 with a car wreck. And then the next scene, she goes in and ruins a baby naming ceremony with her car wreck of emotions. And it's just, I don't know, there are little parallels and details like that that really shine when you give this movie a rewatch.
Yeah, I like the little, it's not subtle, but I like her kind of compulsively pulling at her hair and having that fixation in her life. And then, of course, her alcoholism. And there's clearly some, she needs help, man. She just needs help.
Mm-hmm.
She needs someone who is there for her, someone who can take her seriously and listen to her and not some, and not her parents who are just laughing about her alcoholism. As much as the community is there for her and they feel pity for her or whatever, like, I still feel like this is a accurate depiction of mental health issues in that, yeah, people feel bad for you, but they're not really there for you in a meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
That was my big takeaway as far as the film's depiction of mental health and mental illness.
And you do get to learn that her life has not been super easy. It's annoying how much she focuses on certain things and how she refuses to move past stuff. But then you realize immediately after high school, she had this very traumatic miscarriage that ruined her relationship, made her, mm-hmm. you know, sort of like go into this hysteria at the time that no one understood even then. So probably from that age forward, she had already started compartmentalizing and saying, you know what, I'm just like still in high school when I was good before all this horrible stuff happened to me. You find out she's very recently divorced and her book series has been canceled. There are these things mm-hmm. that are going wrong in her life. And she has no idea how to handle them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not making an excuse for her actions. It's more just giving... Ebert says it beautifully in his review where he's like, if she wasn't an alcoholic, we would think she was just insane. And I agree with his sentiment, but I think it's more than that. I think specifically it's the divorce and the book series being canceled that has sort of caused a break in her. And this is her manic episode that we were watching unfold.
Right. Trying to relive the glory years of high school because things are not going super well. Despite having a successful, quote unquote, successful book series. I mean, it's coming to an end. But, you know, the people in this small town are like, good for you. You have a book series. You're a famous author. And I mean, unless you're Stephen King, I imagine that being a famous author is still a very, very hard life.
Yes.
You are not making a ton of money, really. So, yeah.
It's also like a little mini stereotype that Diablo Cody throws in there that writers are alcoholics. But it's also like a stereotype because it's true so much of the time.
Sometimes you just need a little motivation to finish that page, and it's easy to motivate yourself with a shot of bourbon, you know?
Yeah.
Do you do a lot of writing? I don't think we've actually talked about this before.
Not really. Writing isn't my favorite way to express myself. I do enjoy it. When something comes to me, I will write. And then I enjoy journaling, even if it's just a couple sentences of my day. I like putting in little thoughts of what's happened through the day.
But yeah, that's fun.
As far as, you know, sitting down and saying, I'm going to write this, I have attempted many times and I never make it past the first page.
It's a very hard art form. It's a weird struggle. And a lot of people look at writers and they're like, oh, they're just putting words on the page. That's easy. Anyone can do that. And it's kind of true. Anyone can do that. But obviously it takes considerable talent and dedication to do it well. I mean, I have written a lot in the past. I'm trying to write a lot right now. And there was something about this film and its depiction of the writing process that I found weirdly relatable. When Diablo Cody was saying that she wanted to confront this question about, you know, am I stunted? Do I need to grow up? And she decided to process that question by writing this character and writing this film. There is something kind of therapeutic about writing. Like you said, you journal to kind of process your thoughts. And there's something about weaving together a story and writing a character that's very therapeutic. And you see it being done by this character as well. Like, what is her name, by the way? I just keep saying this character.
Mavis Gary.
Mavis, yeah. Mavis is writing the entire film and kind of processing what she's going through by putting it into the story of this book that she's been hired to write. And I think that's where good writing comes from, is being really honest about the emotions and the stories that we're living in our own lives, and that makes for good art.
Yeah.
That's one of my big takeaways from this film.
Yeah, and she finishes her novel on the way home.
And it's great.
It's probably going to flop. That's the best part, is that it sort of does this parody of the end of a moment of character growth where they finish their book and ride off into the wind and leave that old town behind. This is a very familiar story beat in movies, and it really is almost always depicted as something victorious and to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, you know she's just finished the novel of a series that has already been canceled, and this one is not going to sell well. That has been well established many times. She has left the town, sure, but everyone involved, and mainly herself, is worse off for it. And she's going back to her apartment just to watch more Keeping Up with the Kardashians and drink more. You know, like, I don't know. It's just so great. It's just so great. There's a subversion.
Is that your big relatable moment, is going home to watch the Kardashians?
No. No, it's going home to play Kingdom Hearts.
After learning nothing.
Right. And this movie is wild because it came out the year before I moved, and it was starting to get apparent that I was about to move. And I won't lie, this was exactly the wake up call I needed in that moment of my life. I was watching this and saying, okay, it can't be like this. Like, when I come home, it needs to be good. Like, I still need to keep my friends. There's no point in, like, cutting ties with people and acting like I'm better than anybody, because I know there's a lot of people who want to get out of here. I know there's a lot of people who are cool with staying here, and those are both perfectly legitimate life paths. It does not help that the little shopping mall right outside of the house I used to live in has a Chili's right next to a half Kentucky Fried Chicken A&W. And she drives past those two sitting next to each other. It looks like it's literally the same shopping mall. And I was like, oh no. But yeah, that's my big point of relatability, is going back home and seeing, you know, this weird town. You have all these strange memories in, but where to place them? Where to put them?
Is this an anti-small town film?
Oh, I don't think so. I think if anything, it might be an anti-city film. It does not depict city life very nicely in its opening 10 minutes.
Although true, I mean, the places that she's hanging out in this small town don't seem, they're just not my scene.
Hmm.
The little sports bar she goes to. Ugh.
Ugh.
Ugh. But yes.
Yeah, there's a little gay bar in downtown Birmingham called Al's, which you have to have a membership to get into. And they only had it like that because they didn't want anyone going in there, you know, starting up hate crimes. And even the owners who I've spoken to since have said, we could probably get rid of that system and we'd be fine now. But there's just still something really nice. You don't have to pay for it. And I still have my little Al's card in my wallet. And whenever I go back home, I always go to that bar. I love that place. It is a much cooler, like, there's drag performances and karaoke and stuff. It is a much cooler bar than the sports bars she's going to in, where is it? Mercury, right? Mercury, Minnesota.
Mercury. The fictional town of Mercury, Minnesota.
It's fictional? You did that research?
Yes.
That's good. That's funny. They all call it the Minneapolis.
Well, I see here on like Google's audience rating that there's a ton of 5 stars, but there's also a ton of 1 stars. There's a lot of 3 stars. So maybe you'll like this film, audiences out there.
I would recommend this movie.
I think our audience would love this film. People who listen to A Century in Cinema would love Young Adult.
Yes, it is.
It's good.
It is just such a shocker. It still to this day just shocks something. Maybe it does feel familiar to a certain extent with other Sundance films, but I've still just never seen anything quite like this, because on top of having that shock element, it's really beautifully shot for such a small movie, and the performances in this are next level. I mean, you don't, even though it is so obviously advertised as a Charlize Theron movie and a Charlize Theron performance, and she's the face of it, you really don't feel like you're watching Charlize Theron in this. She melts into this. I don't know. I don't know if you felt that way or not, but she always just captivates me so much, and I'm like, no, I'm watching Mavis right now. This is nuts. And she's never really done a performance like this since.
There are some actors and actresses who, you know, play the same kind of character over and over again, and that's totally fine, Ryan Gosling. But Charlize Theron, I don't think of her as someone who always plays Charlize Theron. She plays a variety, a mosaic of different people within her filmography. Yeah, she's great.
Mm-hmm.
I think something that's really familiar about this film, too, is just that it feels like a film that could come out right now. You said that the depiction of mental health is really contemporary. That's true. But also just the look of it, the people that we see in it, these are actors who are all still very much around today. We keep mentioning in previous episodes how now we're in the modern era. But, I mean, we're really in the era of films where these could come out right now and not be out of place at all.
Mm-hmm. I think the BlackBerry without internet would throw people.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It's making itself, it is a period piece.
Cell phones ruin movies, I swear.
Oh, I really, from someone who is gay and grew up in a small town and was a victim of a hate crime, I gotta say, it is like the funniest thing in the world to me that one of the characters in this is someone who went through a horrifying hate crime. And the worst part of it all is that in the wake of that horrifying trauma, everyone still thinks he's gay, even though he isn't and never was.
Oh my God.
Like, there is just something so dark.
It's dark
about that. And again, the cousin that they both hate, who rolls up in the wheelchair, saying, "You guys are like Will and Grace right now." And she's like, "Yeah, that's exactly what it's like," because she knows he's straight, so she's pressing a button. That is just that is so funny. And everyone in the town at some point, even the people who are well intentioned, even the people who are supposed to like make a comment about, "Oh, it's so sad that happened just because he's gay." Like, no one. Again, coming back to your point of, you know, these people can say they feel bad for you, they have pity, but when it comes to actually being there, to actually knowing you and having support, they don't know how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's shown through him as well. They are two sides of the same coin, which is really interesting. One has found the humor in the situation and the other one hasn't.
Has he found the humor in this situation?
I think he sees life as a joke. Yeah, I think he sees the whole thing as a joke because of his situation. And while he's still sad about it and still has a lot of trauma to carry from it, he has come to terms with the fact that this is his life and he's making the best of it.
Mm-hmm. Is that our episode?
Yeah, I mean, I feel pretty good about that.
Those were as good of final thoughts that I think we've ever had on this show. Yeah, Andrew, thank you for this recommendation. I'm really glad we watched it.
Yeah, me too. I'm happy we did. I'm happy you liked it. I like this movie a lot, and revisiting it was super fun. It is one of the shorter films on our list at 94 minutes, tight movie. We will be following it up with one of the longest movies on our list. next week, we will be discussing Cloud Atlas.
The small independent film Cloud Atlas, and that is not a joke.
Yeah, I was about to say. Okay, I'm happy that's where you were going with that. I was like, wait, now. More details on that to come. But yes, we will be discussing Cloud Atlas, directed by Lily Wachowski, Lana Wachowski, and Tom Tykwer. Oh, and we will be... Sorry, I haven't been out of it, but now at the very end, I'm losing it. And we will be joined by our previous collaborator, Noah Cannon. He was on our Manhattan episode. He will be joining us for the Cloud Atlas episode. So three directors, three podcasters. It's an event you're not going to want to miss.
And he is joining us for comedic effect, right?
Yes, he punches it up. He punches me up. He punches me up and then brings me back down, you know? He loved the, what was the Bosnian War film?
Oh, yeah.
He loved that episode.
No Man's Land.
No Man's Land. He's like, I loved that. He was like, the podcast. He literally sent me a text and said, "The podcast is better when y'all don't know anything." So that's the first punch down. That's great. But yes, that is the end of our episode. To our regular listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. We very much appreciate you. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and review on the podcast streaming service of your choice. And if you would like to hear more of Century in Cinema, you should join our Patreon. The link is in the show notes, as well as on our Facebook posts. Our Facebook page is A Century in Cinema. We do a little bit more relaxed conversations there. It's super fun. We have a great time. All of our Patreon subscribers have come back to me personally and said they find it very funny. Some of them have even gone as far as to say they wish that the episodes were like that. So take that, Arthur.
Who said that?
But thank you so much to our regular listeners and our Patreon members. We got another episode for you coming up right after this. I don't know. Where do they go? Do they click a link? I'm not on the Patreon. I don't really know how it works from a listener perspective.
It's just an app. You can download the Patreon app and you can listen to our episodes there.
Well, cool. Well, we have one of those out, too. I wonder if any of y'all ever listened to that one first or only listened to that one. Anyways, thank you so much to Nathan Royal for our show's music. And thank you, Arthur, for a wonderful episode.
Thank you, Andrew. This was great.